Yes, this past April, I had the pleasure of babysitting our daughter Sarah and her husband Justin's four kids for a week in Stuttgart, Germany. I arrived a few days early just to get into the rhythm of their day, part of which includes Dad reading a few chapters from the Bible while they get settled in their beds each night. They were deep into Acts, so not wanting to have Justin miss the rest of Acts, I asked the kids if they preferred that I read the story of creation and Noah or the story of Joseph. They chose Joseph. And so I turned to Genesis 37. You probably know the story. His father Jacob loved Joseph most and had a coat of many colors made especially for him. But even Jacob finally rebuked Joseph for the grandiose dreams he shared about his parents and brothers all bowing down before him. His older brothers hated him, and they plotted to kill him. They ended up instead selling Joseph into Egypt, into slavery, dipping his ornate robe in the blood of a goat they slaughtered, and then deceiving their father into believing that some ferocious beast had devoured him. And then I went to the next chapter, of course, Genesis 38. At that time, Judah left his brothers and went down to stay with a man of Adullam named Hira. There, Judah met the daughter of a Canaanite man named Shua. He married her and made love to her. She became pregnant and gave birth to a son who was named Ur. She conceived again and gave birth to a son and named him Onan. She gave birth to still another son and named him Shelah. It was at Kizib that she gave birth to him. Judah got a wife for Ur, for his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. And Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the Lord's sight, so the Lord put him to death. Then Judah said to Onan, "Sleep with your brother's wife and fulfill your duty to her as a brother-in-law to raise up offspring for your brother." But Onan knew that the child would not be his, so whenever he slept with his brother's wife, he spilled his semen on the ground to keep from providing offspring for his brother. What he did was wicked in the Lord's sight, so the Lord put him to death also. Judah then said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, "Live as a widow in your father's household until my son Shelah grows up." For he thought, "He may die too, just like his brothers." So Tamar went to live in her father's household. After a long time, Judah's wife, the daughter of Shua, died. When Judah had recovered from his grief, he went up to Timnah to the men who were shearing his sheep, and his friend Hira, the Adullamite, went with him. When Tamar was told, "Your father-in-law is on his way up to Timnah to shear his sheep," she took off her widow's clothes, covered herself with a veil to disguise herself, and then sat down at the entrance of Enim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that though Shelah was now grown up, she had not been given to him as his wife. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. Not realizing that she was his daughter-in-law, he went over to her by the roadside and said, "Come now, let me sleep with you." "And what will you give me to sleep with you?" she asked. "I'll send you a young goat for my flock." "Will you give me something as a pledge until you send it?" Tamar asked. He said, "What pledge should I give you?" "Your seal and its cord," something like this, a little bit more elaborate. "Your seal and its cord and the staff in your hand." Everyone's was different. "Give me your seal and its cord and the staff in your hand," she answered. So he gave them to her and slept with her, and she became pregnant by him. After she left, she took off her veil and put on her widow's clothes again. Meanwhile, Judah sent the young goat by his friend, the Adullamite, in order to get his pledge back from the woman, but he did not find her. He asked the men who lived there, "Where is the shrine prostitute who was beside the road at Enaim?" "There hasn't been any shrine prostitute here," they said. So he went back to Judah and said, "I didn't find her. Besides, the men who lived there said there hasn't been any shrine prostitute here." Then Judah said, "Let her keep what she has, or we will become a laughingstock. After all, I did send her this young goat, but you couldn't find her." About 3 months later, Judah was told, "Your daughter-in-law Tamar is guilty of prostitution, and as a result, she is now pregnant." Judah said, "Bring her out and have her burned to death." As she was being brought out, she sent a message to her father-in-law, "I am pregnant by the man who owns these," she said. And she added, "See if you recognize whose seal and cord and staff these are." Judah recognized them and said, "She is more righteous than I, since I wouldn't give her to my son Shelah." And he did not sleep with her again. And it happened at the time she gave birth that, look, there were twins in her womb. And it happened as she gave birth that one put out his hand, and the midwife took it and bound a scarlet thread in his hand to say, this one came out first. And as he was drawing back his hand, look, out came his brother. And she said, what a breach you have made for yourself. And she called his name Perez. And afterward, out came his brother, on whose hand was the scarlet thread. And she called his name Zerah. Yes, this too is the word of the Lord. Truth be told, when reading this chapter with the Hanley kids, chapter 38 surprised me. And I started glossing over the chapter, starting about verse 8, the story of Onan sleeping with Tamar. I picked up my reading again verbatim about verse 20, Judah giving a young goat to his friend with an eye to getting his pledge back from the woman. And wouldn't you know it, 10-year-old Levi, grandson Levi, immediately piped up and said, Grandpa, why did he have to give him a goat to get his stuff back from the woman? You see, I had sort of skipped that harlotry part. So Levi didn't get the goat and the pledge part either. Why did I cover up so? Although I knew the oddness of the story, it did startle me. It startled me that night, coming as it does in the middle of the story about Joseph. What is it doing there? Why the interlude? Why this interlude? Well, this is what I found upon further study. First, Genesis chapters 37 to 50 are not really about Joseph, but about God keeping his covenant promises despite humanity's boneheaded and self-centered attempts to foil God's covenant by pretending we are in control of our own destinies. And second, Judah becomes a family leader over the course of the Joseph narrative. And Genesis 38 shows us how God took him from a man who did not care about his family, the line and lineage of Jacob, or about doing what was right, to someone who was willing to fight and sacrifice to keep that family, the family of God, together at all costs. In chapter 38, we see how God, through Tamar, taught Judah what it meant to do right for God's people. To get a handle on these things, let's consider first briefly the context. Then, what was Judah like before he professed that Tamar is more right than I? Third, what was Judah like after this encounter, that confession? And finally, how did Tamar, and through her God, teach Judah what it meant to do right for God's people? Now, the context is rather straightforward. Genesis 38 is not a standalone story. As we read in Genesis 37, or can read in Genesis 37, verse 2, what follows is the account of, the Hebrew, the toledot of, Jacob's family line. And the story of that lineage runs right through to the end of Genesis chapter 50. There are two things that are less straightforward, certainly for us today. First is the rite of primogeniture, that is, the blessing given to the firstborn who inherited twice as much as all the other sons, and who would take the lead and have authority over his brothers after their father had died. Just think of the conflict between Jacob and Esau when Isaac is about to die. The second thing that is quite foreign to us is the so-called levirate marriage. It has nothing to do with Levi, by the way, but with a Hebrew word, yibam. The key to the logic of this story is the legal obligation of yibam, which was a widespread practice in the ancient Near East that went into effect when a man died, leaving his wife childless. His closest brother in order of birth was obliged to become his proxy, raising up seed, we read, for his older brother by impregnating his widow. The dead brother would thus be provided a kind of biological continuity, and the widow would be able to produce progeny, which was a woman's chief avenue of fulfillment in that culture. This union between a brother and his sister-in-law does not get codified in Israel until Deuteronomy chapter 25. It's also presupposed in the Sadducees' question in Matthew 22. You might remember six brothers tried to raise up offspring for their oldest brother, but all seven brothers die childless, and the Sadducees' question is, whose wife will she be of the seven at the resurrection? Now, Reuben was actually Father Jacob's firstborn. But we read in 1 Chronicles 5 that when Reuben defiled his father's marriage bed with his father's concubine Bilhah, his rights as firstborn were given to the sons of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh, Joseph being the eldest of Rachel's sons. But would the house of Joseph then always hold sway as firstborn? Would that be how it was going to happen? And what about Simeon and Levi? Simeon was number two, Levi was number three. Well, as Jacob saw things based on their hot-headed assault at Shechem, on Shechem, Genesis 34, their swords were weapons of violence. And I'm referring here to Jacob's blessing on his sons in chapter 49. So how did it come about that David and Jesus, for example, descended from the house of Judah? His character in chapter 38 seems to be anything but commendable. So what was Judah like before his encounter with Tamar? Judah was the fourth son of Jacob's first wife, Leah. And early on, Judah was a decisive man of action, usually acting without any regard for others and taking an influential role among his brothers. So, for example, regarding Judah, we read that Judah said, "What gain is there if we kill our brother? Let's sell him to the Ishmaelites." And his brothers agreed. About the same time that Joseph was sold to the Midianite merchants, Judah moved to Adullam, abandoning his brothers and father, basically to do his own thing, basically to become a Canaanite. And he forgets Yahweh. He forgets his familial identity. He's a man in control of his own life. Judah, we're told, marries a nameless Canaanite woman. The NIV translation has, he met her, he married her, and he made love to her. But more literally, we read, he saw her, he took her, and he came to bed with her. And she conceived and bore him three sons in quick succession, Er, Onan, and Shelah. And once Er was of age, Judah took a wife for him, Tamar. And when Er died childless, Judah, as was the custom in those parts, said to Onan, the second son, "Come to bed with your brother's wife and do your duty as brother-in-law for her to raise up offspring for your brother." But when Onan died childless as well, Judah shirked his duty in not giving his last son, Shelah, to her. Although we are told that the Lord put the first two sons to death, Judah believed that Tamar was bad luck. And he was afraid that Sheila would die just like his brothers. Although he was unwilling to surrender his remaining son so that he could do his duty to Ur and Tamar as promised, Judah nonetheless keeps himself in a position of authority over Tamar, deceitfully sending her back to her father's house, basically leaving her in marital limbo. In this part of the story, too, Judah thought he knew for sure what exactly needed to be done. Now, after Judah's nameless wife dies and the mandatory mourning period has passed, he has no qualms about propositioning a woman on the street who, given her veil, he quickly took to be a prostitute, not realizing that it was Tamar, his daughter-in-law. Self-gratification wins the day. Tamar asks Judah what he's willing to pay to have his way with her, and he offers a young goat from his flock, and his seal and its cord and his staff as pledge. Think he gives her his driver's license and major credit cards, to be returned when he pays up. After this goods for services transaction is completed, Judah left town, having no clue that Tamar became pregnant by him or that she would soon be carrying twins in her womb. Judah later tries to make payment through his friend Hira, but when he finds out that there isn't a temple prostitute in that region, Judah decides to do as he has done with Tamar in the past, out of sight, out of mind, avoid embarrassment, simply cut my losses. When Judah is told that Tamar, who was a widow and in principle betrothed to Sheila, that Tamar was pregnant, he feels no shame when he demands that his daughter-in-law be put to death. Again, not knowing that the twins she was carrying would perish with her. So, what in chapter 38 tells us about how Judah is being prepared for the task that lay ahead of him to secure the future of his family, of God's people? Well, let's consider what Judah was like afterwards. Or, what's the connection here with the Joseph story? Genesis 38 marks the starting point of a fundamental change in Judah's character and mindset. Having been found pregnant, Tamar submits the evidence of her encounter with Judah. And for the first time in his life, as recorded in Genesis anyway, Judah says that someone else is more than he. And instead of lying his way through this difficulty, he seems to accept with meekness what he has come. A process of transformation begins that changes him from a man to become a man who stands in for others. A change that can finally be described by his father with the words, "Judah, you are the one your brothers will praise." Genesis 49:48. Judah's ability to recognize the injustice of his own actions, to admit publicly that he was wrong. And to correct the situation reflects an important change in his character. When Tamar produces Judah's pledge and tells him to recognize to whom these belong, God's humbling actions finally click in his mind and heart. God gave Judah over to his sinful ways, and Judah indulged them until he finally realized how far away from God and his true identity he had gone. Fortunately, God stood at the ready to receive and to redeem his story. Judah became a new man, marked by the fact that his egocentric desires are no longer the controlling force in his life. And the text makes a point to tell us that Judah never had sex with Tamar again. Verse 26. Instead of his one-man show, self-centered ways, Judah begins to make decisions based not on self, but focused on preserving the family of God. And it's the Joseph narrative that shows us this new Judah and God's plans to use him to do right for God's people. Judah returns to his father and his brothers, and to the ways of Yahweh. And he becomes the family spokesman in dealing with the leader in Egypt, who they fail to recognize as their brother Joseph. Judah takes a leading role to embrace the responsibility when they travel to Egypt a second time for Benjamin's safe return to Canaan, Genesis 43. He says to his father, "I myself will guarantee, I will be the pledge of his safety. Father, you can hold me personally responsible for him. If I don't bring him back to you, Father, I will bear the blame before you all my life." And when family unity is threatened in chapter 44, when Benjamin is accused of stealing the silver cup Joseph drinks from and used for divination, Judah once again comes to Benjamin's defense and pleads with Joseph on behalf of his brother, offering to take Benjamin's place and to himself become Joseph's slave. Judah is willing to sacrifice himself to keep his family intact. And on his deathbed, Jacob, Genesis 49, blesses his son, declaring that the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet. Judah and his descendants became a stronghold in the line of preserving and leading God's people all the way to Jesus, the Lion of Judah. From one quick to abandon the life and people of God, to one who repented and was changed, learning from his life experiences of God's will, and humbled by God's grace and mercy, Judah became not just one transformed by God, but God's agent of blessing for God's people. His first two sons, Ur and Onan, are dead. But when Perez and Zerah, the twins of Tamar, are born, his grandsons, they too step into the family line. Perez was the forefather of Jesse, the father of David. So how did Tamar, and through her God, teach Judah what it meant to do right for God's people? In what sense was Tamar more righteous than Judah? As might happen with the larger-than-life characters in a Flannery O'Connor story, the outlandish Tamar and her bizarre deed shock Judah into seeing divine purpose at work in the world and enable him to become an example to his brothers. When Tamar returns the pledge that identifies Judah as responsible for her pregnant state, Judah finally recognizes himself as the guilty one. Not just for having sex with a prostitute, but for how he has treated Tamar all along. He is the one who stands condemned, not she. He is the one who has something to be ashamed of, not her. She did deceive her father-in-law, but only because he denied her what she was entitled to. Tamar is never condemned for her actions. Instead, because of what she did, Judah is humbled and sees how far away from God's will he has gone. She is more right than I, he says. And he never again takes advantage of her or his brothers for his own gain, but instead respects and provides for them as family. The Old Testament concept of rightness or righteousness is not simply a matter of morals. It's better understood as a key ingredient for shalom, for flourishing. When an act in the Hebrew scriptures is described as right, it is because that action preserves and grows the well-being of the community. When the word is used as a verb, as it is in Tamar's case, it means the subject, Tamar, is right before God and before the law. Though we might be tempted to see Tamar's actions as sinful and shameful, the biblical text tells us that God does not. Tamar and Judah's union is part of the lineage that leads to Jesus. She's one of the four women mentioned in the lineage of Matthew 1. The microcosm of well-being for the family of Judah in Genesis 38 leads to the macrocosm of the well-being for the world in Christ. It's yet one more story about God working for good. The plans and events in the lives of his people, no matter what the circumstances. At great cost to herself, Tamar educates Judah in the meaning of marriage, and therewith also in the meaning of being a brother, a husband, and a father, and more generally, about living within the family of God. Now, Genesis 38 is probably near the top of the list of least preached texts in Scripture. There's death, by the hand of God, no less. Sex, both in marriage and outside of it. And lots of things that parents might not be ready to have their children understand. But to let sex and all its related pieces keep us from this story is to keep us from learning important things about God's view of human righteousness. Both Tamar and Judah give us a window on what it means to be right with God. And remember, he's got the whole world in his hands. Ask the praise team to come up. We'll sing number 751 from Lift Up Your Hearts. The last verse goes this way. What we have heard, we will teach our children. May they have ears to hear God's word. Let us, through every generation, make God's wonders known. We stand to sing when the music plays.